I'm very happy to be here, to be part of the Thomistic Institute, which is new. And it's kind of a blaze, a star in the sky now, that everywhere I turn, I'm getting something about the Thomistic Institute. And I also should say that I'm pleased to be here among the Dominicans. And I don't think maybe Dominic knows this. I was received in the full communion in the Dominican House of Studies in D.C. Now Archbishop Denoyer, Gus Denoyer, was one of the clergy at the time. So I have a particular fondness for that. I'm not a Thomist. In fact, and probably it's not a nice thing to say among the Dominicans, I see Thomas as just another one of the church fathers, of which there are many others, so he's not the one. But I have Thomas always close at hand and love turning to him in when I need some help on theological matters. I'm sort of backed into this topic, and it goes way beyond things that I normally am working on, as Carlos Sayre, Reformation scholar, will discover tonight, and wondering why Wilkin is talking about such things. But so be it. And I want to tell you a story about how, in my view, religious freedom came to be sort of the way of understanding the relation between political and religious authority in our civilization in the West. And so I'm going to kind of give you an account, and then at the end I'm going to try to bring it down to where I think we find ourselves today. Once upon a time, it was thought that religious freedom was the work of the Enlightenment. In the 16th century, so the story goes, as the Reformation made its way across Europe, confessional differences led to the suppression and persecution of Christians by Christians, Catholics, Calvinists, Lutheran Catholics. In time, religious differences hardened, and Protestant and Catholic armies faced one another on the field of battle. A half century of bloody conflict, so-called wars of religion, was set in motion. But by the end of the 17th century, men with greater wisdom and less religious fervor came on the scene, and the fanaticism of religious believers gave way to the cool reason of the philosophers. Armed with notions of religious belief about the superiority of reason to faith, skeptical of received truth, and distrustful of religious claims and institution, these enlightened thinkers forged a new set of ideas about toleration and religious freedom. Through their labors, the modern idea of liberty of conscience was born. Now, this tale has been modified in recent years. John Locke, whose letter concerning toleration, published in 1689, was viewed as a charter document of religious freedom. This has been deposed. He's been deposed from his place of honor. Good example, in her book, The Liberty of Conscience, Martha Nussbaum argued that the first and most articulate exponent of liberty of conscience was Roger Williams, who lived two generations before Locke. But she and others have much too short a historical perspective. The origins of religious freedom in the West are to be found many centuries earlier in the writings of Christians who wrote in defense of the right to practice their faith in the cities of the Roman Empire. So we must begin at the beginning, when Christianity was making its way in the world. In antiquity, and in the cities of the Roman Empire, religion was an affair of the community as a whole. Through public rituals and private ceremonies, the ordinary and extraordinary events of communal life were set within a cosmic and sacred frame of reference that bound people together in a single religious and civic community. No form of life was wholly secular. Because religion was so much part of the fabric of life, the Romans were suspicious of foreign cults. And so when they began to make their way into the empire, they were an affront to religious sensibilities. They learned to make their peace with them, but they still were very suspicious, even into the 3rd and 4th century of the Roman Empire. The one religion that would not conform, of course, was Judaism. But the Jews had a long history, an illustrious history. And the cities of the, especially of the Eastern Roman Empire, the magistrates worked out an arrangement that they would allow the Jews to follow their way of life without interruption. Christians, however, were different. They were not an ancient people. They claimed no city or land is their own. They believed in one transcendent God who welcomed all peoples, Jew and Greek, as the New Testament has it. When first mentioned by Roman writers, Christianity was called a superstition, which meant a degraded and alien cult, and the term stuck. Other foreign cults were syncretistic. They adopted the Roman ways while they continued to venerate their own gods. Not so the Christians. They steadfastly refused participation in Roman rites. Now, the ancient accounts of the martyrs give us contemporaneous depictions of what happened when Christians were brought before Roman officials. For example, in Scyllium, in present-day Tunisia, the group of Christians was arraigned before the proconsul. They were asked to swear by the genius of our Lord the Emperor. When they balked, the proconsul asked, "Why do you malign our sacred rites? Why will you not give up your beliefs? We too are a religious people." In another case, the Roman governor urged Christians to worship and venerate what he said, the gods all of us worship and venerate, and so continue to live in our midst. In plain Latin or English, if you want to live here, do what the rest of us do. If not, you will be subject to punishment. So Christians protested. They were being treated unjustly. And in defense, they wrote apologies, that is, treatises in defense of their way of life. And among early Christians, no one was more ardent in spirit and lucid in argument and more fun to read than Tertullian, a convert to Christianity in Roman Carthage, which is in present-day Tunisia, the first Christian to write in Latin. One of his earliest and most substantive treatises, the Apologeticum, the Apology, was an incisive analysis of Roman policy toward Christians. The sole charge, he said, was that we Christians do not follow Roman ways. We are not considered true Romans because we do not worship the gods of the Romans. But why, asked Tertullian, must everyone pray in the same way? Let one man worship God, another Jupiter. Let one lift up hands of supplication to the heavens, another to the altar of Fides, God of trustworthiness. Let one count the clouds as he prays, another the panels on the ceiling. Let one consecrate himself to God, another to a goat. Then he comes to his point. See that you do not end up fostering irreligion by taking away religious liberty, libertas religionis, and forbid free choice with respect to divine matters, so that I am not allowed to worship what I wish, but am forced to worship what I do not wish. So he's the first in Western civilization to use the phrase religious liberty. And when one cuts through the irony, worshiping goats and clouds, his strategy is transparent. Expose the banality of conventional piety. Religion consists of more than dutiful gestures and solemn rituals, what he calls religion with the fingertips. It has to do with inner conviction, with an act of the will. And by using the term freedom, he advances the truth that there is a self-governing realm within the human breast, free of external curbs, and this space must be respected. A decade later, he writes another treatise, this one directed to the Roman governor, a man named Scopoli, called On Scopoli. He says, "We worship one God, whose existence is known from nature, and we do not understand why you will not allow us to venerate God as we see fit." Here's what he says, and this couple of sentences is at the center of what I'm about. "It is only just and a privilege inherent in human nature that every person should be allowed to worship according to his own convictions. For one person's religion neither harms nor hurts another. In matters of religion, coercion has no place, for religious conviction is a voluntary act, cannot be forced. It must be held willingly." I'm not going to talk about this tonight. Thomas Jefferson knew this passage. And he actually writes it out in his own private copy of the Notes on the State of Virginia, at the place where he says, doesn't matter whether you worship one God or 20 gods. The point I'm trying to make, I'm not going to go into that tonight, is that there's a tradition that begins in the second and third century that lives on well into the early American period. Now, Tertullian is not making a legal argument. His case is moral and rests on the biblical understanding of the dignity and freedom of human beings. Early on, Christians had defended free will. Free will is essential for the moral life, or else you're not responsible. But he has more in mind. He draws, even though he doesn't mention it here, because he's writing to an outsider, he draws on the biblical teaching that human beings are created in the image of God. So the key text is Genesis 1:26. "Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created him." For Tertullian, this passage, quoted several times in his writings, was taken to mean that human beings are possessed of reason and animated with divine life. "Man was created by God as free," he says, "with power to choose and power to act. There is no clearer indication of in him of God's image and similitude than this, the outward expression of God's own dignity." First point is that religious faith cannot be coerced because human beings are endowed with freedom. But he has another argument, an appeal to conscience. In Latin, the term for conscience is conscientia, knowledge with, and it's best translated as consciousness or recollection. It signified the awareness that one's thoughts, dispositions, and acts carry moral obligations that could be judged by others as well as by oneself. And in the letter to Romans, Paul uses the term. He uses it in Greek, synesis, rather than conscientia. But he understands the term to mean more than simply looking back, because he says that it obliges human beings to do what is written on their own hearts. And he calls it a natural moral sense, a pedagogue to the soul, a guide and a companion to admonish it to do what is better or to correct and convict it of faults. Tertullian takes the term conscience and he uses it then as another weapon against the Romans. "We refuse sacrifices because of our conscience," that is, the knowledge, conscientia, that we possess. "Some think we have lost our minds because we could simply offer sacrifices and walk away unharmed. And they are baffled by our obstinacy. But the testimony of the soul," and that's one of the titles of a little work of his, "the testimony of the soul does not allow us to act against what we know deep within. Just as the hand cannot write what the soul is not dictated, so the tongue can only sing the melody of the heart." So much then for Christian antiquity. What Tertullian and other Christian thinkers, there's another one, Lactantius, who's 100 years later, another Latin writer, wrote was largely ignored after the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine. Religious freedom, someone said, is a loser's creed. So with the establishment of a Christian society in which there was an alliance between church and state, religious dissenters, principally the Jews and the heretics, became subject to restrictive social conventions and laws. But the ancient axiom that religion could not be coerced was not forgotten, and in the Middle Age, the understanding of conscience was deepened and applied in new ways. I had to quote Thomas, so here comes Thomas, all right. For Thomas Aquinas, conscience was an inner spiritual forum conscientiae, that has to do with matters of the soul, which means that the bond of conscience is greater than the command of a superior, and it obligates even where there exists a command of a superior to the contrary. And he gives some examples. A person is bound to obey his fellow men in matters that have to do with the body, those things over which a superior has authority. A soldier must obey the general in matters of war, and a servant on matters that have to do with his duties. In the same way, members of religious orders must obey in matters that have to do with the ordering of their common life. But if a superior orders something that is contrary to God, it is wrong to obey. Obedience is obligatory only in those matters to which the vow of obedience extends. And there are a number of examples of this in the Middle Ages. One case is Petrus Johannes Olivi, a Franciscan theologian in the 13th century. He was suspected of heresy, but was unconvinced by the charges. He said that he would acknowledge his teachings were in error if it could be shown from the scriptures and the church's tradition that they do not conform to the Catholic faith. But if not, I cannot go against my conscience, that is, my soul's knowledge. So then the two points then, one, religion cannot be coerced, and conscience is an inner moral voice. I turn to Carlos's feet, the Reformation. The rhetoric of the reformers of the 16th century called for the reform of the medieval church. But the Reformation inaugurated a great transformation in Western civilization with far-reaching consequences for the relation between religion and society. Within decades of the posting of the 95 Theses by Martin Luther, the institutional unity and cultural cohesion of Western Christendom was breaking apart. The Peace of Augsburg in 1555, Elizabethan Restoration in England in 59, the organization of Calvinist churches in France in the 1560s, the old world was fading. What began as theological opposition to the medieval papacy led to the rise of confessional churches, that is, bodies who were united around a distinctive confession of faith. They were no longer bound together as Christendom, but fragmented into what later came to be national churches, or what later yet we called denominations. Religion was no longer the vinculum societatis, the bond that held society together. So the most consequential change wrought by the Reformation was the emergence of settled religious minorities within cities or territories that for centuries had been united by a common faith. Christians in the 16th century, however, whether they were Catholic or Protestant, could not imagine a peaceful society divided by religious belief. As a leader in the Polish Reformation put it, where people are not held by a common faith, no other bond will hold them together. Hence the resistance to these confessional communities. In France, the axiom was one law, one faith, one law, one king. But with the growth of Calvinism in France in the late 16th century, the axiom no longer made any sense. And the Frenchman who had seen the changes in his country put it this way: would you ever have thought in your youth that you could one day see in France such chaos that within one town there would be several religions practiced? And by religions, he doesn't mean Muslims or Buddhists. He means other kinds of Christians. So the cities were faced with a new problem: how to deal with nonconformists who were organized in religious communities. Give you one example. I owe this to a student of Protestantism. In Nuremberg, in Bavaria. By 1520, members of some of the leading families and humanists had become supporters of Luther's ideas of reform. Soon the city council began to appoint reformers to key positions in the city and instituted liturgical and institutional changes. By the mid-1520s, the Reformation in Nuremberg was at full throttle, and the city became one of the first Lutheran cities to prepare its own church order, a legal document setting forth Lutheran doctrine prescribing uniform liturgical practices for churches. Most significantly, it was the city magistrates who were responsible for the changes. Very important to keep that in mind. So what did they do? They began to dismantle the monasteries. But the Sisters of St. Clair, a community of religious women with a long history, resisted. And in 1524, the abbess of the monastery, the convent, Caritas Pirkheimer, began to keep a diary that gives a first-hand account of changes that were being imposed. The Franciscan priests were sent away, mass was prohibited, evangelical clergy were dispatched to preach long sermons. They preached 111 sermons to these poor women, convinced the sisters to accept the reforms, and they sent in people to watch that the sisters paid attention. And as we all know, anybody who had an experience with religious sisters, relatives, women, they responded by stuffing wool in their ears so they could not hear the sermons. The city magistrates assumed that there should be one religion in the city. Now, as dramatic as Pirkheimer's tale is, even more telling is how she defends her community. Again and again, she says, the sisters are being forced to act against their consciences and are being deprived of their spiritual freedom. We hope, she writes, that the Honorable City Council will not apply pressure in matters which concern our conscience and force us to act against our wills to confess what the authorities want us to say. We had always obeyed them in temporal things, but what concerned the soul, we can only obey our conscience. Note the distinction there between two kinds of authority. Now, it is ironic that in defending fidelity to the old religion, Pirkheimer uses language similar to what Martin Luther used at the Diet of Worms. When asked to recant his teachings, he replied, unless I am convinced by scripture and plain reason, I do not accept the authority of the popes and councils, for they have contradicted each other. My conscience is captive to the word of God. I cannot and will not recant anything. God help me. Now, legend has it that Worms, the Diet of Worms, Luther said, here I stand, I cannot do others die. But there's no certain evidence of this. However, one of the sisters of the Franciscan community, Katharina Emna, said, here I stand and I will not yield. Whether she was the first to use the phrase, here I stand, I don't know. But it is possible the sisters heard of Luther's declamation at Worms and deliberately mimicked his words, standing up to the unjust demands. Or maybe she was the first to use it. But that's not the point. The important point is that Caritas Pirkheimer and Martin Luther shared a common understanding of conscience handed on in medieval Christianity. Freedom of conscience was a Christian inheritance, and both the reformer and the sister held on to something that they had both received. It is not the creation of the Reformation. What is also significant is that Pirkheimer reproves the magistrates for transgressing the line between spiritual and religious matters. It's not the business of the city council to determine religious preaching or practice, he says. And at least one member of the city council, a man named Freilich, also challenged the action of the magistrates on the same ground. So he wasn't worried about the sisters, he was worried about the Anabaptists. What surfaces then during the Reformation is a very old distinction within Christianity, what we call the two swords. Going way back to Pope Gelasius. For the medievals, it was Pope, and of course then the emperor or a king. But the most articulate exponent of this in the 16th century was John Calvin in Geneva. This is what he says. There are two realms, and they are to be viewed apart from each other. One sphere has to do with spiritual matters, the other with public order, safety, food, housing, the needs of the present life. The laws which allow human beings to live together. Government has no authority on things that pertain to the second table, has authority only the things that pertain to the second table of the Decalogue, the laws of society. The things of the first table, honor God, the life of the soul, none of their business. One can find this same distinction most unexpectedly in a French Catholic statesman, Michel de L'Hôpital, who was chancellor in France in the latter half of the 16th century, when the growth of Calvinism was a serious threat to the stability of French society. And in a bold speech, 1561, before the Estates General, he said that religion is not the proper business of the state, because he was trying to find a way to make space for this disruptive new confession. Religious questions, he says, are to be dealt with by the church. It is not the task of the chancellor to make judgments about doctrines of religion. The question, he says, before the assembly was not de constituenda religione, not about maintaining religion, but de constituenda republica, about maintaining the commonwealth. Many can be citizens who will not be Christians, that is, Catholics. In effect, he abandons the ancient axiom, one faith, one law, and one king, and acknowledges the inevitability of two religions in the French kingdom. Now, if you listen closely to what I'm saying, you realize that what we're talking about here is not primarily the rights of individuals. It is customary to think that the development of liberty of conscience in the 16th century was about the right of individuals to believe what they wish. But the central issue was not individuals, but the rights of religious communities. And the first person to really say that clearly was a Dutch writer, around the year 1580. He said, liberty of conscience is not enough. For it only allows for the private practice of religion. It did not address the social fact of a minority, religious community, living within the midst of a society. And a Dutch thinker, magnificent name. Can you imagine having a name like this? Marnix de Eldegon. Put it this way. No one has been executed or harassed merely on grounds of conscience. That's not quite true, but anyway, his point is clear. But always for committing some public act in words or practices. How is it possible to grant freedom of conscience without exercise of religion? If they have no ceremonies, they do not invoke God. Then there is no liberty of conscience. What needs to be secured is the freedom to assemble, to preach, to catechize and profess openly when they what they believe in their inmost hearts. I'm not certain of this, but I suspect this is probably the first time that someone used the phrase free exercise of religion. The Dutch were also the first to say explicitly that liberty of conscience is a natural right, not something that is bestowed. It's an anonymous Dutch writer in about 15. It is well known that human freedom is located particularly in the soul, which is the chiefest part of us. Freedom of the soul means freedom of conscience. The freedom consists in the fact that a person may accept and hold such a religion as his conscience witnesses to him, and in fact that no one has the right or the power to hinder him in it or violently forbid it. This freedom does not have its origin in the action of a state, but belongs to a person by nature and is a natural right, because religion is a bond that a person has with God. It's for this reason that he owes an account to no one besides God alone. Okay, where have we gone? Religion cannot be coerced. Government is not responsible for maintaining order. Religious freedom must be more than individual liberty, but freedom of worship, free exercise. The liberty to worship God as one wishes is a natural right, not a benefaction of the government. These ideas are in play by the end of the 16th century. They are not implemented in many places, and they were actually opposed by kings and queens. And in these writers, they quote Tertullian and Lactantius in support of these ideas, which are not the ideas of Lactantius and Tertullian. These are ideas which were building on those. They were forged largely in continental Europe, Switzerland, France, Low Countries, and they made their way to the English-speaking world. By the early 17th century, they had been adopted by Baptists in England, though resisted by the English crown, embraced by those who came to America to establish colonies in the New World, most notably Roger Williams. This one passage from Williams. No civil magistrate, nor king, nor Caesar have any power over the souls or consciences of their subjects. In England, they were defended by a whole series of writers, even a Catholic writer, Father Robert Persons, Jesuit, Jeremy Taylor, an Anglican, John Owen, an independent or Congregationalist, and William Penn, a Quaker, to name several. Which brings me back to where we began. If after reviewing this history, one takes in hand Locke's famous letter on toleration, it is clear that all the ideas are found in earlier writers. He argues in language almost taken from Calvin that one must distinguish exactly the business of civil government from that of religion. And at several points he says that faith is the inward and full persuasion of the mind, of the heart. The significance of Locke is not that he advanced new ideas, but that he dropped all the supporting texts from the earlier centuries, and he synthesized an ongoing debate in philosophical address. And it was in that form that it was transmitted to later generations in England and to the American colonies. In Virginia in 1771, the separate Baptists did not apply to the crown for a permit to preach required of non-establishment, that is, non-Anglican clergy. In 1773, an Anglican clergyman on horseback interrupted a Baptist preacher singing a hymn. With the help of the sheriff, he dragged him into a field and flogged him. A few months later, with a large group of separate Baptists held a convention at Blue Run Church in Orange County, where James Madison lived. It was the largest crowd ever assembled in Orange County, and Madison truly knew of the gathering and would have led up to it. In 1776, he was elected, Madison, a delegate from Orange County to the Revolutionary Convention of Virginia that met in May of that year. He was placed on the committee to prepare a Declaration of Rights for the colony. The document that came to the committee had 16 articles, one of which dealt with religion. Though he was a very junior member of the committee, only 24 years old, the article on religion stirred him to action. The original draft of the article was written by George Mason. That, as religion, or the duty which we owe to our divine and omnipotent Creator, can be governed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence. Therefore, all men should enjoy the fullest toleration of the exercise of religion, according to the dictates of conscience. Madison did not like the word toleration, because that was a benefaction, it was an indulgence, it was allowing something that you didn't like. So he rewrote it with a significant alteration. He eliminated the term toleration and in his place wrote that all men are equally entitled to the full and free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience. Now, several years later, in a response to a bill Patrick Henry had proposed, establishing a provision for teachers of the Christian religion, in fact, a new form of establishment, but including more than the Anglicans, he wrote his Memorial and Remonstrance. Here's what he says. Because we hold it for a fundamental and undeniable truth that religion or the duty which we owe to our Creator, and the manner of discharging it can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force of violence. The religion of every man must be left to the conviction and conscience of every man, and it is the right of every man to exercise it as these may dictate. This right is by its nature an unalienable right. It is unalienable because the opinions of men depending only on the evidence contemplated by their own minds cannot follow the dictates of other men. It is unalienable also because what is here a right towards man is a duty toward God. It is the duty of every man to render the Creator such homage as he believes acceptable. This duty is precedent, both in order of time and in degree of obligation to the claims of civil society. That is, it's a natural right. Before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a subject of the governor of the universe. Maintain, therefore, that in matters of religion, no man's right is abridged by the institution of civil society, and that religion is wholly exempt from its cognizance. My argument is not that the church fathers were the immediate source of ideas developed by Madison and Jefferson. As I said, Jefferson didn't know the Tertullian text. The route from antiquity to the 18th century is long and circuitous. The ideas about religious freedom formulated by the founding fathers, religion having to do with beliefs about God, religious convictions springing from inner persuasion, hence not subject to conversion. The distinction between a civil and religious realm, liberty of conscience as a natural right prior to the state, all have their origin in Christianity. It was Christian thinkers who first set forth notions of freedom of religion in the ancient world and defended the dignity of the human person. It was Christian philosophers and theologians who developed an understanding of conscience. And it was a dualism of political and spiritual authority, rendered to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, that provided the foundation for the idea that civil government and religious belief must be kept separate. Such ideas were not the work of the Enlightenment, but were born not of indifference, not of skepticism, nor of mere open-mindedness, but of faith. Now a brief epilogue. In the early years of the 21st century, the defense of freedom of religion is no less necessary than in ancient Rome or early modern Europe, or in colonial America. Though we live in a country that has made freedom of religion one of its founding principles, there are powerful forces at work seeking to undermine what we have received. Some are asking whether the very idea of freedom of religion is intelligible in a secular society, one that has systematically sought to exclude the name of God in our public life. In a book entitled Why Tolerate Religion, the Chicago philosopher Brian Leiter has argued that traditional arguments for the uniqueness of religious beliefs, religion having to do with the duties we owe to our Creator, are clearly false in our world today. As American society becomes more pervasively secular, there will be little reason to give a privileged place to religion. And in time, the idea of religious freedom will become unintelligible to non-religious people or transformed into something different, freedom of speech or expression. But religious freedom is about actions, not simply words, about practices, which by their very nature are communal. This is most evident with relation to marriage. What is at issue is not what Christians believe about marriage, though the day is coming quickly if it hasn't already arrived, that those who hold to traditional marriage will be labeled bigots. But what we practice, a ritual in which a man and a woman are joined together in a sacred union. Today, it is still possible for Christians to resist the new law of the land and to remain faithful to the scriptures and tradition to bless the union of a man and woman in marriage. But as time passes, it will become more difficult, for there is a tendency in the human mind to assign normative authority to the existing state of affairs. What becomes conventional and commonplace is thought to embody a moral imperative. It is the right thing to do. Secularism is increasingly intolerant of Christians, and the secular potentates of our society put to us the question Roman magistrates put to Christians centuries ago. Why do you not do what all of us do? Recall the passage in the book of Esther in which Haman, the evil prime minister of the Persian king Ahasuerus, tells the king about the Jews who live in his kingdom. There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. So it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. I think that pretty well describes the mood in our society today about certain matters. As Americans, we know that religious freedom is a principle enshrined in documents that gave rise to our country. It has been incorporated in our laws and it is honored by our people. But civilization is a thin and fragile thing. And if not cherished and defended, it can be lost. If the things we hold dear become detached from the cultural traditions that have created and sustained them, they will wither and die. And if religious freedom is emptied of religion, that is, a belief in a transcendent authority, it will lose its potency. As Christians, we must bend our efforts to guard and nurture the ancient convictions of our people and remind our fellow citizens that we are bound together as one nation under God. But the name of God will not be invoked in the public square if the panoply of public power subverts Christian practice. Without belief in God, there will be no religious freedom, and in time, less and less Christian practice. If religious freedom is to be preserved in our country, it is a task of Christians to keep alive the name of God in the public square. And to do that, we must remain faithful to who we are, speaking our language, thinking our thoughts, and celebrating our distinctive rituals, not doing what others do. And we must pray, as the prophet Isaiah did many centuries ago, that God will pour on the thirsty land and on streams on the dry ground. God will pour water on the thirsty land and streams on the dry ground, that the people of our great country may spring up like grass and mid water, like willows by flowing streams. Thank you.